This is Read Japanese Literature. My name is Allison Fincher. Read Japanese Literature is a podcast about Japanese fiction and some of its best works. All the works we discuss are available in translation, so you can read along if you want, and you can learn more about those translations at readjapaneseliterature.com. Today we're looking at the Meiji era of Japanese history and its literature. The shogunate is replaced, Japan looks outward to the West and inward toward itself, and a man named Natsume Soseki chronicles it all from the perspective of a stray cat. Particularly in Western poetry, based as it is on human affairs, even the most sublime poem can never aspire to emancipation from this vulgar realm. It is nothing but compassion, love, justice, freedom. Such poetry never deals with anything beyond what is found in the marketplace of the everyday world. No matter how poetic it may be, its feet stay firmly on the ground. It has a permanent eye on the purse. Happily, in the poetry of the Orient, there are works that transcend such a state. By my eastern hedge, I pluck chrysanthemums, gazing serenely out at the southern hills. Here we have purely and simply a scene in which the world of men is utterly cast aside and forgotten. Beyond that hedge, there is no next-door girl peeping in. No friend is busy pursuing business deals among those hills. Reading it, you feel that you have been washed clean of all the sweat of worldly self-interest, of profit and loss, and a transcendental release. This passage comes from Natsume Soseki's 1906 novel, Kusamakura. In the novel, a first-person narrator takes up the kinds of philosophical questions that challenged Soseki and his generation. What can the Japanese learn from the West, and what must the Japanese not leave behind? Today we're going to think about those questions in the context of Japan in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. We'll take a look at where contemporary Japanese literature drew its inspiration. It looked back to Chinese and Japanese classics. It looked around at contemporary European and American literature, and in some ways ahead to the rising nationalism that ultimately contributed to World War II. By the 1720s, Edo, or Tokyo, was the largest city in the world, with an estimated population of more than a million people. But the 19th century wasn't kind to Japan or to its capital. The population was pushing up against the limits of the food and resources that the archipelago could produce. Less than 10% of the population was samurai, but of those, most were underemployed and in financial trouble. Lower-born samurai were resentful that their efforts were often unrewarded by better positions and pay. And just as in most any society, it's the lowest people in the upper echelon that are often the biggest threat to the people in power. Plagues and fires continued to be major threats in all of Japan's major cities. In the 1830s, widespread famine killed tens or even hundreds of thousands of people. The Tokugawa shogunate, which had ruled Japan more or less peacefully for 250 years, was in trouble. And it's in that context that on July 8, 1853, U.S. Commodore Matthew Perry sailed his four black ships into Tokyo Harbor. He carried a letter from President Millard Fillmore addressed to the Emperor of Japan. And you may recall that the Emperor of Japan was at this point not actually the man in charge. But this is what that letter said. "We know that the ancient laws of your Imperial Majesty's government do not allow foreign trade, except with the Chinese and the Dutch. But as the state of the world changes and new governments are formed, it seems to be wise from time to time to make new laws. Just a week later, Perry sent this additional letter to the emperor, and this time he was a good bit more direct. "If you are still to disagree, we would then take up arms and inquire into the sin against divine principles, and you would also make sure of your law and fight in defense. When one considers such an occasion, however, one will realize the victory will naturally be ours." In the end, the Tokugawa government was more or less forced to sign the unequal treaties. Japan was forced to open its ports to foreign trade. It couldn't set its own tariffs, meaning that cheap Western goods would flood its markets, and American and many European foreigners could only be charged with crimes in foreign courts under foreign laws. Now, there are many reasons that the shogunate collapsed after 1853, but these unequal treaties were kind of the last nail in the coffin. The last shogun, Yoshinobu Tokugawa, effectively lost power in 1867. On January 3, 1868, a number of samurai deposed Tokugawa and proclaimed the young emperor the ruler of Japan. You may remember, as I just mentioned, that the emperor hadn't held any real power in Japan for more than 1,000 years. And he didn't really hold power after the Meiji Restoration either. The restoration really just changed who was pulling the strings. For what it's worth, the last shogun, maybe surprisingly, wasn't killed by the men who replaced him. He became a member of the nobility, took up a seat in the House of Peers, and eventually fathered more than 20 children. Now, I have heard the Meiji Restoration called peaceful or even bloodless, and that's not at all true. The death toll from the Meiji Restoration was in the tens of thousands. It's just that tens of thousands is much smaller than the casualties of other 19th and early 20th century revolutions and civil wars. The emperor, born Mutsuhito, was named for the period between 1868 and his death in 1912, the Meiji period. The Meiji period saw the transition of the emperor's country from a feudal, pre-industrial economy to a partially modernized nation-state, at least in Japan's major cities. We'll discuss some of the major cultural changes of his reign in just a minute. As always, this has been a major oversimplification, but it gives us some context to understand the literature of the Meiji period. Andrew Gordon's book, History of Japan from Tokugawa Times to the Present, is an excellent resource for this period of Japanese history, and there's a link for that book on our website. Basil Hall was a British scholar who lived in Japan for most of the Meiji era. This is how he described that moment in Japanese history. "To have lived through the transition stage of modern Japan makes a man feel preternaturally old. For here he is in modern times, with the air full of talk about bicycles and bacilli and spheres of influence, and yet he can himself distinctly remember the Middle Ages. The dear old samurai who first initiated the present writer into the mysteries of the Japanese language wore a queue and two swords. His modern successor, fairly fluent in English and dressed in a servable suit of dittos, might almost be European, save for a certain obliqueness of the eyes and scantiness of beard." Now, of course, there's some Orientalism and some significant national pride here in the case of Hall's account, but the spirit of his observation is generally true. At least in the imagination of many Americans, the Meiji era is mostly characterized by forward momentum from America and Europe. Some historians even use the term the Japanese Enlightenment. That's an understandable, though pretty Eurocentric term. There was indeed a lot of momentum in Japan to adopt and adapt from the West. This movement is often subsumed under the title Bunmei Kaika, or Civilization and Enlightenment. And this movement pushed forward technologies imported from Europe and the United States, things like railroads and telegraph lines. It also encouraged certain intellectual trends and even modes of dress. There are probably hundreds of examples of the ways Westernization and modernization shaped Japan, but I'm going to limit myself to the ways it changed literature. First of all, modernization and Westernization changed the way that Japanese people read. Starting in the 1870s, there was a growing number of Western-style newspapers with an increasingly large circulation. Meiji newspapers and journals have a long-lasting impact on the Japanese publishing industry, as we'll discuss in a later episode. And the Japanese, for the first time, could read the works of European authors like John Stuart Mill, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and Herbert Spencer in translation. The move toward Westernization also marked contemporary literature. The novel has been the quintessential literary form in Europe and the US for long enough that we sometimes forget it's relatively new. Genre studies is the field of literary studies that seeks to identify what book belongs in what category. It's very complex. So I'll just characterize the novel in my own way as an extended work of prose narrative fiction, usually involving some characterization and maybe character development. As we discussed, many people, including me, would class The Tale of Genji as a novel based on this definition, but there are some questions about the writing that comes in between. Really, though, the novel as a literary form only came into its own in the 19th century. But many Meiji period writers quickly took European and American novels as their models. Among these, Natsume Soseki. And we'll talk about how the novel developed in Japan in a later episode. In the West, some of the most enduring literature of the late 19th century is from the naturalist movement. To again oversimplify, naturalists like the French writer Émile Zola tried to create a more scientific and objective literature. Stephen Crane, the author of The Red Badge of Courage, is one of the most famous American naturalists. A number of 19th century Japanese writers wrote as naturalists as well, but their works aren't widely available in English translation. It is some of the writers who deliberately moved away from naturalism whose influence in the West has been the most widespread. Authors like Mori Ogai, Nagai Kafu, and Junichiro Tanizaki. Authors that I hope to take up in a later episode. Natsume Soseki in his own work spoke specifically about his objections to the naturalistic style. In Kusamakura, he wrote, "Strictly speaking, in fact, there is no need to present this world in art. You have only to conjure the world up before you, and there you will find a living poem, a fount of song. No need to commit your thoughts to paper." But it's also easy to overstate Japan's cultural shift westward. For one thing, Japan's modernization and industrialization are parts of a cultural shift, an economic shift, in many parts of the contemporary world, including, I might note, large parts of the U.S. For another, there was also a strong backward pull toward older Japanese traditions, and this was especially apparent starting in the 1880s. One contemporary journal, called The Japanese, asked whether Japan was in danger of, quote, "forfeiting its national character and destroying all elements of Japanese society." People continued to promote traditional Japanese arts, like playing the shamisen or the koto, things like kabuki theater. Ironically, the very process of preserving Japanese culture from the West has shaped modern attitudes about Japaneseness. Some observers of Japanese culture may not realize, for example, that no theater, survived the Meiji period in large part because it was promoted by the government as an answer to Western opera, and some of the ritualistic aspects of no aren't original to the form at all. They actually date to the Meiji period. Judo, sumo wrestling, bonsai all took on their symbolic meaning as metonyms for Japan during the Meiji period. The Japanese government also intentionally reinforced Confucian ethics, which we'll discuss in an upcoming episode. If you'd like to learn more about the impact of the Meiji Restoration, there's a fantastic podcast series called Meiji at 150, and you can find a link on our website. Natsume Soseki was one of the most persistent advocates for slowing the headlong rush toward American and European culture. Soseki was born in 1867, just a year before the Meiji Restoration. His parents were already in their 40s and 50s and didn't especially want another child. His education marked him as a child of both the old world and the new. He had a strong grounding in Chinese and Japanese classics, but he went on to major in English literature at Tokyo University. He decided that a major in English literature was the best way to become a modern writer. He also thought that Japan needed the learning of the entire world before Japan could develop its own modern, individualistic way of thinking. Soseki began his career as a school teacher. He was soon engaged to a woman named Kyoko Nakane. Soseki considered himself an eccentric, and with good reason. He guessed from her photographs that Kyoko was an eccentric too. After all, as he later wrote, though she had bad teeth, she made no attempt to hide them from view. It turned out that the mental instability the pair shared wasn't compatible with a happy marriage. And just a side note, because I sympathize with Soseki on this, during this period of his life, Soseki spent almost 20% of his salary on books. In 1900, the Japanese government made Soseki an offer he really wasn't free to refuse. And so he spent two extremely lonely years in England. By the time he returned home, he was on the verge of a mental breakdown. His experiences in England led him to question exactly what was to be gained by Japan's wholesale adoption of Western culture. He wrote, "I do not know if the gentlemen of England are so impressive as to make it worth my while to imitate them. Having already spent my youth in the Orient, why should I now start learning how to conduct myself from these English gentlemen who are younger than I am?" And Soseki never blindly followed European and American culture. He wanted to avoid what he called putting a Westerner's head on a Japanese body. He was especially interested in avoiding Westernization in the context of his writing. He wrote that Japanese writers must imitate literary techniques from Western literature simply to develop those qualities peculiar to themselves. And it is precisely this work to which Soseki devoted his career. In much of his writing, Soseki also takes up the anxieties of his age. And these anxieties pervaded the literature of most modernizing societies. The impersonality of modern culture, the precarious balance of the new and the old, and the competing forces of the individual and the group. Specifically in Japan, that last took on the form of the competing forces of personal freedom and then filial piety to family and emperor. At the beginning of this episode, I read a passage from Kusamakura. Kusamakura is an artistic and earnest novel, but the novel I want to discuss today is not. Some readers complain that I Am a Cat isn't serious, but I think that's unfair. It isn't a frivolous story, although it is a funny, biting work of satire. It's also worth noting that it harkens back to the spirit of the low literature of the Edo period that we discussed in an earlier episode. Soseki published the short story I Am a Cat in a literary journal in January of 1905. Much to his surprise, I Am a Cat became a smash hit. In the end, the story grew much longer than he had originally planned. It turned into 10 installments and was eventually published as a serial novel. The translation available from Tuttle Press comes in at a whopping 480 pages. In short order, Soseki used I Am a Cat as a springboard from the university to a job as a fiction writer for one of Japan's most popular newspapers. He worked as a professional writer from 1907 until his death in 1916. So let's talk about I Am a Cat. I Am a Cat opens with the narrator, a cat who never quite manages to get himself a name. He wanders into the home of a schoolteacher, Kushami. Kushami may or may not be Soseki's self-caricature. Most English language translators of I Am a Cat translate the characters' names, too. This is rather unusual in translated literature. So I'll introduce the characters first with their Japanese names, but then refer to them moving forward with their names in translation. Kushami, generally translated as Mr. Sneeze, is the absent-minded professor. His caricature translates well across cultures. He's forgetful and impractical. He suffers from a sour stomach and is a little bit neurotic. This is the way the cat describes him. He does actually spend much of his time with some difficult book propped up before his nose. One must accordingly regard him as a person of at least the scholarly type. And then the cat goes on, "It would seem that for my master, a book is not a thing to be read, but a device to bring on slumber, a typographical sleeping pill, a paginated security blanket." Sneeze's wife is perpetually at her wits' end because of her impractical husband. And she's not all that happy that her husband has taken in a stray cat. As a new member of Mr. Sneeze's home, the cat meets a host of colorful characters. Maytay, or Mr. Waverhouse, never takes anything seriously. He reminds me of the character Algernon Moncrief in Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest. Tofu Ochi, or Mr. Beauchamp, is a poet, much like the English Romantics of the beginning of the 19th century, and he claims to write from experience and sensation. Kangetsu Muzushima, or Mr. Cold Moon, is one of Sneeze's former students. He is a PhD student today in the sciences. The Kanedas, or the Goldfields, are maybe the most comic characters. They are a thoroughly westernized family living in Mr. Sneeze's neighborhood. Their daughter, Tomiko, translated sometimes as Opula, is beautiful, prideful, and spoiled. In the end, this is what Mr. Sneeze concludes about the other characters. "As I review the list of my friends and acquaintances, I begin to feel considerably reassured. The truth may simply be that human society is no more than a massing of lunatics." Some readers complain that I Am a Cat is too episodic, but there are stories that wend their way through the entire narrative. Maybe the most amusing is the courtship of Miss Opula Goldfield. Beauchamp, the poet, has written a volume of poetry dedicated to her, but her family pursues Cold Moon as her suitor. They are, after all, a nouveau riche family, and bringing someone with a PhD into their family would be a sign of how modern and Western they really are. Meanwhile, Cold Moon is too busy to court Opula properly, and this may sound familiar to anyone who's spent time in academia. His PhD project involved grinding a glass sphere to perfectly represent a frog's eye lens. He expects it will take him 10 years to get it right. Mrs. Goldfield continually butts into Mr. Sneeze's life, trying to weasel information about Cold Moon. In the end, Cold Moon grinds his glass ball into a tiny fragment, gives up, and then quietly returns to his hometown to marry a girl there. Some of the concerns that Soseki raises in I Am a Cat are very tied to a particular time and place. But many of his satirical characters are as relevant today as they were in 1905. There are people with more money than taste or manners, people who think they are better than others, people who are simply full of it, people who have no practical skills, people who spend their lives focused on narrow topics that aren't of value to anyone else. And people who buy too many books. This complaint by Sneeze's wife is one of my favorites. He is totally abandoned in the way he buys book after book, never to read a single one. I wouldn't mind if he used his head and bought in moderation, but no. Whenever the mood takes him, he ambles off to the biggest bookshop in the city and brings back home as many books as chance to catch his fancy. Then, at the end of the month, he adopts an attitude of complete detachment. So far in this episode, we've looked at Japan and its literature's look outward to the West, to modernization. And we've looked at its examination inward toward its Japanese traditions. I want to finish very briefly by pointing out that Meiji period writers were pretty prescient about the rise of nationalism that would eventually draw Japan into World War II. For one thing, Japan was already following models of European and American imperialism. Japan looked around East Asia with apprehension. So many of their neighbors had fallen to Western imperialism. To significantly oversimplify, many leaders of the Japanese military seem to have adopted the attitude, if you can't beat them, join them. Japan started wars over Korea, first with China and then with Russia. It also invaded what is now Taiwan and made it a Japanese dependency starting in 1895. We've also already noted the development of new ideas about Japanese-ness that developed in the face of modernization and westernization. I'd like to tackle rising nationalism more in a later episode, but for now I'd like to note that prescient Meiji observers, including Soseki, knew what was coming. In Kusamakura, Soseki wrote, "Love may be beautiful. Filial piety may be a splendid thing. Loyalty and patriotism may all be very fine. But when you yourself are in one of those positions, you find yourself sucked into the maelstrom of the situation's complex pros and cons. Blind to any beauty of fineness, you cannot perceive where the poetry of the situation may lie." So why should you read I Am a Cat? First of all, Soseki is widely accepted as one of Japan's most important writers. I Am a Cat is an important artifact of a special cultural moment. And overall, I'd encourage you to read I Am a Cat because frankly, it's hilarious. If you want to read along, I've been using Aiko Ito and Graham Wilson's translation of I Am a Cat, as well as Meredith McKinney's translation of Kusamakura. Both are available in print form and as audiobooks, all linked at readjapaneseliterature.com. If 480 pages seems like too big of a commitment, I'd encourage you to take a look at the manga edition. You can find a link on our website. This has been a history-heavy episode, but I've still had to oversimplify. For more on the history of Japan, check out historian Isaac Mayer's podcast, and our website links a couple of relevant episodes. Next time, we'll take another look at the Meiji era, but this time as women writers re-enter the stage. If you want to offer feedback or suggestions, maybe ask a question you'd like us to answer in the podcast, you can tweet us at @readjapaneselit. A special thank you to Adam Sola for production assistance. Thank you to the Japanese Literature Twitter community and the Japanese Literature Group on Facebook. And thank you to producer Kime for today's music at Kime Music and KimeMusic.com.